Good morning, Council. While you're getting settled, I'll just remind you of our rules. You each get 15 minutes for your argument. Council for Appellant, you will have 5 additional minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you both state your name, identify the party you represent. At the beginning of your argument, the podium, you can raise or lower it. There's a button underneath the middle of it so that it serves your purposes. And with that, please do take your time that you need to get your papers and things settled. But when you are ready, Council for Appellant, we are ready for your argument. I guess it's relator, not appellant. I get that mixed up. Relators.
Understood. May it please the court. John Ioli for Relator Safe Flight Solutions, LLC, and with me at council table is my colleague, Richard Snyder. In reading the briefs getting ready for today, it struck me that there's something that really has gone into the background that's very important. And it's sometimes the case when you live with a matter that you lose sight of a big picture. And the big picture here that I don't think is really spelled out in the briefs but is replete in the record is we're talking about first notice of loss, glass-only calls. That's our business. We're not talking about collision at all. This is not a glass and fender bender. This is not a totaled car with a glass claim or a car that might be totaled and it's in dispute. What we're talking about here is only first notice of loss, glass-only claims. And so that's everywhere in the record, and everything that you see talks about auto glass claims. And we've never really spelled that out for the court, and that's our miss, but I wanted to rectify that now.
So, Mr. Ioli, who cares? Why is that important?
It's relevant to the question of investigation and negotiation. And so what we have here
your client does neither.
It does neither.
Okay. You know, on the settlement, though, and I'll let you answer the question. When are these claims settled?
Well, the question of settlement, in my mind, goes to a point of a contested claim or a disputed claim. These are not disputed claims, so there's no settlement.
So you're saying your client closes claims, he doesn't settle them?
I would say settlement in the context of an adjuster.
Because I assume, yeah. Well, you, so, okay, so the person at the call center, you know, gets the insured on the phone and, you know, gives the script, and the person says, okay, you know, let's use Joe, fine, you know, I'll use them. Is the claim settled then, or is the claim settled when that glass supply person is paid whatever it is he's paid that, you know, the consortium has agreed to pay?
I take the court's point, Your Honor. There, the word settlement, I think, has different meanings. And what we have taken it to mean is settlement in terms of a dispute and a coming together of differences. I think the court's suggesting, well, it could be settlement in terms of after you have dinner at a restaurant, you settle the check. Now, the argument of settlement in that context has never been made by the department. They've never raised it, never made it, never charged us with that. And so in that respect, I would say it hasn't been brought to bear against us, and therefore Judge LaFave didn't deal with it, and the commissioner's decision maker didn't deal with it. And in that respect, I'd say that...
But, I mean, we're applying the plain language of the statute, and it's de novo review, so based on these facts, we have to determine whether or not your client is settling claims or not.
I agree with that. I mean, I certainly
so
don't.
So your position is they're not?
They're not.
Okay. Why not?
They're not settling the claims because, in our view, for a licensed adjuster to be required, that connotes an adjustment. And an adjustment, in that sense, is a matter that is pending and it could fall to several different outcomes. And to settle that would be to say, well, you've said that 30% of your car has been damaged, and we've taken a look at it, and we think it's only 20%. Or if you have hail damage, the adjuster comes out and says, well, we think this part of your roof is hail, that part is wear and tear, so here's what we're going to come to. We'll come to an adjustment and settlement. And so I think in terms of reading the statute in connection with what is being licensed, I would say settlement in that context is really an agreed compromise or solution of some sort.
So, Mr. Eiley, what are we to make of the colloquy that occurs that the briefs talk about, where the call center person, who may or may not be 16, says to the insured, here's what your insurance company will pay for this repair. And certainly you can go to anybody you want to get it fixed. But if the company that you've chosen charges more than what your insurance company is going to pay, you might have to pay the difference. That sounds a little bit like adjusting to me and trying to control the cost for the insurance company, which is what adjusters oftentimes do.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, it did certainly get litigated, and your question is a good one. Our response to that is, this is not adjusting. This, and here is why. We would say, if someone comes and they have a glass job, we say you can use anybody you want. And in some cases, a glass shop might be on the phone, and as you say, they'll say, we will say, here is the reimbursement rate, and if the shop disagrees, as you say, we would say, well, that's more than what XYZ insurance company will pay. If the shop charges more, you might have to pay the difference. We litigated that in front of Judge Nelson in federal court. And she held, and her opinion is both it's in the record and in the authorities. But anyway, in the record, she held a truthful statement such as that are a protected and.
Well, I mean, they may be protected. That doesn't mean Judge Flory's excellent point. You know, that you're still not adjusting.
Yes, I should have really come to that. There is no effort there. Or ability, frankly, no discretion to change a term. And so we say it's much like the department store example that I gave in the brief. And in another example, for example, if I go to go to a hardware store and I say, can I buy some rock salt to de-ice my driveway? And the clerk says, well, I'll certainly sell you some salt, but, you know, calcium chloride is going to work at temperatures below 10 degrees. More expensive, in our view, that's not a negotiation. It's some statement of information. And coming back to an important point, from our perspective and our insurance company client's perspective, it's very important for that customer to know that if he or she can go anywhere they want, but if they go somewhere that is going to charge more than the insurance company agrees to pay, the customer needs to know that, because it shouldn't come 60 days later when they could be balance billed.
Mr. Ayala, I had a somewhat different question. Let's say, for the sake of our argument, we agree with you as to the first issue, which is that under the statute, your clients are not investigating, settling, or negotiating. Does that dispose of the entire case, or do we still have to address the issue of whether these subpoenas with a penalty issue, i.e., is this a subpoena, is this a request, blah, blah, blah?
It disposes of the first two issues.
Okay, but not the third.
Not the subpoena issue. And I wasn't planning to actually deliver argument on the third issue, but I'm happy to do so.
Can I ask a different question? If SafeLight is not an insurance adjuster or an independent adjuster, as defined by the statute, what is it?
A third-party administrator.
And does the commissioner have authority over third-party administrators based on the statutes at issue?
These statutes, the only third-party administrator regulations I know of in Minnesota pertain to health care. And so this particular statutory scheme doesn't have a mechanism for consumer electronic devices. We saw that. It came out in the in the respondent's brief where they said, hey, if what you're doing is something you wanted to do, then you need to go under, and I don't have the statutory section at hand, but it's actually a consumer electronic device claims adjudication, computerized claims adjudication system. And so my answer is there would be a way to provide for it perhaps, but this scheme doesn't do so.
Now, there's been reference to arbitration awards that, and I think arbitration proceedings that Safelite was not a party to. I assume that the issues in those cases had to do with the reasonableness of the reimbursement rates being paid to the glass companies.
They did.
Okay. So none of the issues here really are policy holder driven issues.
They aren't. There have been no complaints. Well, if have been no complaints to the Department of Commerce. If someone makes a complaint to an insurance company, we hear about it right away. The insurance companies listen to the calls. We have to record every single call, and they are extremely interested in customer satisfaction because people will just go to another insurance company if they don't like who they have.
What is your company doing? It seems to me this case really has that your company plays a couple of different roles. I mean, one is this third-party administrator or manager. I think that those two words have been used. And the other is sort of what I've, in my mind, talk about the back office stuff. I mean, it's the setting of the reimbursement rates and the role that you've played with your insurance company clients in trying to figure out what reasonable rates are throughout the state of Minnesota, because it varies from time to time. I mean, in that other kind of capacity, does the Department of Commerce have authority over you in that, or your company in that capacity?
I would say over the insurance companies, yes. Over us in that respect, no. And there's a very important disagreement, and I think the record's absolutely clear. We do not set rates. There's an example contract in the record. And if I
Don't you present the insurance companies with information and they decide what they're going to pay over or under a particular rate?
That's what happens. But they at the outset of our relationship, an insurance company will determine its rates independently. Then there is this list price, which is incredibly complicated. It's for every piece of glass made. It changes three times a year. What we do is take a predetermined algorithm that the insurance company comes up with for its glass pricing by statistical area, and we tell them how it flows through based on this three times a year change. We don't say, hey, you should change your price to this. It said, applying your previous benchmark, here's what's going to happen based on the change in the NAGS price. National Auto Glass Specifications.
But aren't you actually telling them, though, by contracting with us and using the information we provide you and adjusting your rates accordingly, we will save you money because you won't be paying as much for those glass claims. Otherwise, it doesn't seem to me there'd be any attraction to contracting with you as a third-party administrator.
Judge Fuller, you make two points, really. It's absolutely true that using us as a TPA will reduce the cost to the insurance company by sending out the back office. The insurance company still has to pay to set its prices. And you can see from an example we put in the brief, the prices are all over the lot. And there's no other explanation for that except that the insurance companies set the pricing. Otherwise, you wouldn't have one paying 15% over NAGS and another paying 30% under NAGS for the same piece of glass in the same location. The other point I think that's very important is cost. And it's something that I asked the commissioner's investigator, so what do you have in mind here in his deposition? What are you thinking? I mean, we don't agree, but let's just say you're right and I'm wrong. You want us to license 1,000 customer service representatives in Arizona, Ohio, and Iowa to take glassware from Minnesota only? The only place where it would happen. And he said, I just can't speak to that. And so what I want to come to is if that were to happen, a couple things could result. We'd license 1,000, or we would have to create a Minnesota-only section of customer service reps or the insurance companies would have to take the work back. And in the short run, that would certainly, any of those scenarios would increase the cost to us and increase the cost to the insurance company. And ironically, the place where it's going to land, I'm not an economist, and I don't know exactly how rate setting happens, but it's going to increase the cost of glass repair in Minnesota for the consumer. And Minnesota, it's in the O'Mara affidavit, totally unrebutted. Highest cost in the United States. Hawaii, Alaska, Wisconsin, all lower than Minnesota, and the cost will go up. And so I think that's an important point worth considering. With that, I have 9 seconds, if the court wishes.
You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
You can pick it up there. I'll counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Oliver Larson. I'm with the Attorney General's Office. I'm here to represent the Department of Commerce. I think one of the fundamental issues here is who sets pricing for glass. Is it the shop or is it the insurance company? Because that's really essential to their argument on negotiation, right? What they're saying is the insurance company sets the price, the reimbursement rate is paid for a job, and therefore when they tell somebody the price is X, it's not a negotiation, it's just a statement of what the price is. This court has looked at that argument twice before and rejected it twice before. Once in a published decision, once in an unpublished decision. We cite to these cases on page 14 of our brief. These are the Byright case and the Glass Services case. So let me take a step back and kind of explain.
Well, presumably that's how they've come up with this carefully calibrated call script, don't you think?
I don't know how carefully calibrated it is, but yes, they're very much looking.
They've tried to, well, I would assume they've read that decision and come up with this call script. So I guess the question is, first of all, do you agree that no person who's had glass replaced that has complained about this?
That we know of, although the explanation—
That you know of.
Yeah, the explanation for that is this. The glass shops eat the cost. When there's a dispute, what happens is the glass shops either, if they get short paid, they either eat the cost or they sue the insurers. They don't
get assignments. I mean, we've had all kinds of glass
litigation
for years.
They don't try and take it out of the hide of their customers. And so, you know, that's the reason why you haven't seen any customers complaining, because they're getting the work done and they're not getting balance bill. They're not having problems.
So then your complaint is you believe that the glass replacement folks are not getting, you know, Well, what is your complaint? What is the Commerce Department's concern for glass replacement folks?
The issue here is that
they're not getting fair commercial, whatever the magic language
is. Right, exactly. Right. They're not getting.
Okay.
They're
not. How will designating all of these people who work at the call center insurance adjusters fix that?
Well, I will say this. I don't think that this, I think it's a bit of a red herring to say that they're going to have to license everybody. They know when they get calls in from Minnesota.
Well, wait a minute. It's my understanding that is precisely the issue you are complaining about, that these people are not licensed and must be. Therefore, if we affirm the decision of the Commerce's designated representative, that is precisely what will happen. Are you saying that's not what you want?
No. What I'm saying is, if let's say they've got 1,000 customer service representatives, they're not going to have to license 1,000 people, right? They're going to have to license some small number of people to handle the calls from Minnesota. And they already have systems in place that allow them to know that the call's coming in from Minnesota, because that's how their scripts are set up. They've got an Illinois-specific script. They've got a Minnesota-specific script. They've got an Arizona-specific script. They know where the call is coming from. And so if they get a call in, they're not going to have to license, you know, thousands of people to
deal with the situation. No, but they're going to have to have... Oh, go ahead, Judge Brewer.
Well, the script itself, you mentioned the script. I mean, the script comes right from the statutes in terms of what information needs to be provided to a policyholder, correct?
I guess portions of it, yes.
Right. I mean, the fact that we can't tell you where to go, you can go wherever you want, this is just what your insurance company will pay. I mean, that there's nothing inaccurate about the information provided.
What we're contesting in particular is the language of offer and acceptance. When they tell an auto shop, we want to pay X, Will you accept that amount of money? That's a negotiation. I don't know any way around saying that the language of offer, I don't know how you can have the language of offer and acceptance and say that there's not a negotiation going on.
But don't they actually say your insurance company will reimburse this amount? They don't say we do that, do they? And don't they say if your insurance company is AAA, here's what AAA has determined that they'll pay for a windshield repair?
They go one step further. They then say to the auto shop, will you accept that amount of money? And if the auto company, if the auto shop says no, if the glass repair shop says no, we're not going to accept that amount of money, they immediately then tell the, basically start running a part of the script that's designed to get that customer to not go to that shop and instead go to a shop that's affiliated with Safelite.
So what difference does that make from the shop's perspective? They can still do the job. They get paid what the insurance company will reimburse, and they do have the ability to sue the customer for the balance, don't they? But they've chosen not to. So why should the Commissioner of Commerce be concerned about that?
Well, I mean, look, if you're going to negotiate, you have to be licensed. That's just what the statute says. So, I mean, we can debate the policy behind it, but the legislature has decided that...
They're not negotiating a price, are they? They're negotiating a repairer.
Aren't they just conveying in? Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go
no,
ahead.
You. I'm sorry.
They're not just conveying information. The purpose of that part of the script is to try and get that shop to agree to a particular price that the insurance company wants to offer. And maybe, you know, take a step back. One of the issues I'm going to talk to you about how this market works.
So what? I mean, I get it. You know, if reading between the lines, you know, if I'm the person who wants my glass replaced, I'm going to go, all things being equal, with, you know, whoever's in their system. And you know what? If I'm the glass manufacturer and I don't like that rate, I'm going to say no. And I agree and I accept both of those things. But how is that negotiation? I mean, to say no is, I mean, I want this. You can't have it. Goodbye. I mean, I think that's how the president negotiates, but I don't think that's how anyone else in the world negotiates. It's like, well, what about, you know, would you give me an extra $10 or you know, blah, blah, blah. Or you know, all right, we'll give you $50 and maybe we'll come get your car. You know, because I know some of these things you got to drive there or they come to you. But I really am at a loss to understand, Mr. Larson, as to how this isn't negotiation. So why don't you tell me?
Well, look, you may decide that there has to be a back and forth through the negotiation. I disagree with that. You're going to have to make a call on that. But I don't think there's, if you look at definitions of the word negotiate, none of them say that the negotiation doesn't start until there's a second or third offer, right? I mean, it's the language of offer and acceptance. If they're saying, we're offering X, will you accept it? And it's, and again, getting back to the point, they don't set the pricing. If you go and read this buy right place in the glass, that's the same argument that the insurance companies made when they were getting sued for these deficiencies, right? They said, hold on, we set the price for our reimbursements, and as long as what we're paying is within the range of reasonableness, we get to set the price. And this court said, no, you don't. The auto shop sets the price, and if the auto shop's price is within the range of reasonableness, you, the insurer, have to pay it. So they've made this argument before that they are the price setter in this relationship. They are not. And so when they're going to a glass shop and saying, we're offering X, will you accept it? They're basically, there's the language of offer and acceptance, that's a negotiation. If, you know, this court wants to determine that there needs to be more than that, I mean, I guess that you can do that. You're going to have to make a call on what the language means. But, you know, to me, you know, it doesn't take multiple back and forth there to be negotiation. I mean, if you're using the language of offer and acceptance, that is a negotiation. And then to get to the harm here, the real harm is this. These auto shops were short paid by millions of dollars, like plural millions of dollars. And not only that, the same shops were having to go to arbitration, get an award, and then the next day the insurance companies and Safelite went right back to short paying them. And that means basically every other year they've got to file a new arbitration.
And how is that going to be solved by having some adjusters involved?
Part of the findings here are not just that they are adjusters, but there was also a substantive violation of the adjusting statutes, right? It's not just that they were adjusters, it's that they were short paying people. Right? And so I agree with you. If we had just, you know, okay, they're adjusting, but nobody was hurt, would the department even have gotten involved? No. But the case here is not only were they acting as adjusters, but they were creating real harm on shops that had to repetitively sue the insurer companies to recover millions of dollars, even after being told that the mechanisms they had in place for payment were wrong, that they were using the wrong standards in the wrong way.
I'd like to shift briefly to the whole issue of the penalties. So for whatever reasons, your people decided to go the subpoena route. So to avoid these penalties, and when they got the subpoenas, they objected, what should they have done to avoid the penalties? Are you saying they should have moved to quash the subpoenas, and because they didn't? I mean, what should they have done to avoid these penalties? I mean, they didn't give you the stuff. They said they weren't going to give it, so they didn't just blow you off. So what should they have done to avoid the penalties?
Well, initially, and I don't know how much this is in the record, initially they just said, go away. Okay. And then they later objected.
But are you saying it's their, you know, it sort of sets out in subdivision 3 and 6 the sort of scenario as to how these things work. So is it your position what they should have done is, because they didn't move to quash the subpoenas, it's they're on the hook now if we win? I mean, is that the idea?
Let me say this. And be candid in saying, I personally, and I doubt that the department very much cares about what the civil penalty is. I think what we're really here to vindicate.
Well, my hunch is.
my hunch is they spent more money on their lawyers than they've spent on civil penalty. But the issue for me really is this. I think we do need to have, or we need to avoid or have this court be very careful about how it deals with the statute in this respect. If we get a decision out of the Court of Appeals that says you can ignore a subpoena unless the department goes to the district court and gets an order compelling it, nobody will ever respond to a subpoena. That's what's going to happen. And not only that, every time the department issues a subpoena, it's going to have to pay a filing fee in Ramsey County to go and get that subpoena enforced. That can't be the law. And if this court has concerns with whether it's fair to tag somebody with $10,000 for failing to respond to a subpoena, I share that concern. I think a $10,000 civil penalty for failing to respond to a subpoena would probably be grossly excessive. In this case, the civil penalty wasn't split up between the various violations. So I don't know what the appropriate thing would be here, but I think it would be appropriate for, in an appropriate case, to get an order saying you're fined $100 for failing to respond to the subpoena or something like that, if that's the issue. So I want to focus more on the substance of reading these statutes than on articulating whether the civil penalty is the right remedy. Ultimately, what we really need to deal with is, can the commissioner enforce his or her own subpoenas? And I think that has to be the case. And if you look at the language of the statute, that's clearly what it contemplates. And, the couple of words that I think are key in there, first of all, when the statute talks about there being, a different penalty, it's clearly talking about, something other than $10,000, because some statutes say that the penalty may be capped at $50 or $500. And also, a district court action isn't a penalty, right? It's a different forum. So reading the statute to say, we can impose a penalty unless there's a different penalty specified, and the different penalty is that we might drag you off to district court, doesn't strike me as being a very credible reading of the statute.
I'd like to take you back to, I guess, 72A20, the statutes that we're really talking about. I don't think that Commerce is taking the position that it is inappropriate to have a third-party administrator or management, are you?
No, and look, if all they were doing was just purely collecting information, passing it off to the insurance company was making decisions about what to do with that, clearly allowed. If in fact, there was clear guidance from the insurance company that was put into a computer algorithm and all they're doing is running the computer algorithm, even that might be okay. But when we talk about the fact record in this case about who's making these decisions, you are correct. There is no evidence that the insurance company ever made any of these decisions. I mean, we went to USAA, which was one of their clients, and we said, we're actually interested in figuring out who sets the pricing, right? Who's making these decisions? And so we said to USAA, give us all the correspondence between you and Safelite discussing how you're going to set this pricing. We got one document. That one document was essentially a document that went from Safelite to USAA saying, unless you tell us differently, this is how we're going to do your pricing. That's it.
Right, but that's
the only document.
But that's not the complaint about. I mean, that's not the conduct that is alleged to require licensure. I mean, what I'm struggling with is what's been attacked as the work of the minimum wage 16-year-old third-party managers or administrators, and yet it seems that the real goal of this litigation is to put SafeLight out of the business of coordinating the actual payment or reimbursement rate. And so I'm struggling with where did the statute impact that? And secondarily, my question is, how does the Commerce's Department's action help reduce the fact that we have the most expensive auto glass coverage in the nation?
Well, I look, that whether we have the most expensive or not, it's not really, I mean, I don't think it's that relevant to the statute, which is why we didn't spend any time really dealing with it. I don't actually know if that's true. But on your point, just break out, when we're talking about the people who are on the telephone, our allegations of that's the negotiation part of the case. When we're talking about investigation, we are very much talking about the back office operations of SafeLight.
That's the actual violation of underpaying.
And what we're saying is, all the evidence here, I mean, in the arbitrations, when insurance representatives took the stand and were asked, how are these calculations done? They said, we don't know. That's done by SafeLight. I don't know what else to say. I mean, the investigation, the analysis that goes in determining what a piece of glass should cost or what labor should cost is being done at SafeLight, and then the insurance companies are just being asked to say yes or no on that. It looks like my time is up.
Whether they just say yes or no, aren't they ultimately on the hook to pay it? Isn't that where the contract is between the insured and the insurer and not between the insured and SafeLight?
Yeah, if you'll indulge me, I'll respond to that by saying this. I think you're correct. Contractually, the obligation to pay lies with the insurer ultimately. But when we talk about what the core functioning of adjusting is, it's an insurance company taking a determination on how much should be paid on a claim and giving it to somebody else. And that's what's happening here. The insurance companies are taking the task of determining how much a claim should be paid, and they're giving it to SafeLight.
Thank you. Mr. Ioli, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'm not sure where to begin, but I'll start with pricing and the back office function. First of all, the statute, the licensing regulation and statute applies to investigating glass claims. What Mr. Larson was just talking about was someone in Ohio comparing glass prices all over the country and looking at the NAGS pricing. Those are completely different things. And so I would say that's in no sense someone investigating a glass claim. The other thing is, he said, well, we got one document back from auto owners. Well, at the outset of the relationship, the insurance company determines the pricing. Everything that happens after that is a pure application of that price structure to the new information published 3 times a year by a publishing house that publishes glass prices. There's no setting of prices. And let's talk about pricing for a second. Mr. Larson is saying, hey, look, the glass shops set the prices, not the insurers. Well, that's true. A glass shop can charge whatever it wants. It doesn't mean the insurance company has a contractual policy obligation to reimburse that amount. So that's different. What the CSRs are saying, the customer service reps from SafeLight are saying, this is what your insurance company is willing to pay.
But then they go farther and they say to the company, are you willing to accept this? That does sound like a little bit of a negotiation to me.
Well, Your Honor, we say it because we need to know. Because if we need to tell the policyholder, if the glass shop will not, then the policyholder can go forward and do whatever they want. They don't have to, they don't have to change. And the point is, Mr. Larson keeps saying the language of offer and acceptance is negotiation. We completely and fundamentally disagree. If you go to McDonald's and you say, I want a hamburger, how much is it? And the clerk tells you, and you said, fine, I'll have a hamburger. That's not a negotiation. It's certainly the language of offer and acceptance. So the two are not the same. And so what
if I go to McDonald's and I asked how much for a Big Mac and they say $2.75 and I say, well, I only have $2.50. Are you willing to take it? Is that a negotiation?
That
seems more similar to what the script is.
I would say
is.
It might be an effort to initiate a negotiation, which is what Mr. Patton said, but when the clerk says, I'm sorry, it's $2.75, that's the price. Mr. Patton, the investigator, lead investor, agreed. That is not a negotiation. And our CSRs never vary the terms. They can't. They're set. This idea about millions of dollars of unreimbursed claims, that's not in the record. I have to say. It's not in the record. There is a format for glass shops who believe they've been underpaid. Those are the arbitrations that are that happen whenever a glass shop decides it wants to pursue an arbitration, no-fault arbitration, against the insurance company for what it sees as an underpayment. Since we're on that, we really have two glass shops that initiated this whole investigation, and it's all through the record. I don't need to get into it, but the reality is this was a little bit of a spiked investigation, we would say, based on two very, very active glass shops who are far and away the highest charging glass shops. In terms of licensing, a minimal number of CSRs would need to be licensed. That's nowhere in the record at all. Mr. O'Mara says there are at least 1,000 CSRs who could take a Minnesota claim. And we have to remember, a Minnesota driver could be anywhere. I mean, the Minnesota driver could be in Arizona, could be in Florida. And if they've got a Minnesota insurance, it comes in and we have to deal with it on a Minnesota basis, which we do, but we don't have a dedicated pool of CSRs and wouldn't anticipate creating such a pool if we didn't really have to do it. In terms of the language of the scripting, and Mr. Larson, I mean, I don't think he intentionally did so. He editorialized. This is not record-based that says it's intended to do X, Y, or Z. There's nothing in the record like that. The idea is, from the insurance companies, tell these callers what the situation is. It's clear under Minnesota law, as well as insurance company policies, whatever the insured ends up doing is on the insured. They have a choice. They can do whatever they want. I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
I do have one more question. Okay. And I guess I'm the only one who's interested in the penalties. Okay, so something Mr. Larson said struck me as being very important and changed my view on, if it's a subpoena, then there's no penalty. You've got to go to court. And I have to admit, I share Mr. Larson's concerns that I don't want people – I would agree that I don't think it would be a good practice – for any time the Department of Commerce wants to enforce its subpoenas, which it's allowed to issue, it's got to go to court, because then everyone will fight them every inch of the way. So let's say, for the sake of argument, I have that concern, which causes me to read perhaps that statute not in the way you read it. And let's say, for the sake of argument, I don't think you were denied due process or didn't get an evidentiary hearing or all the rest of those arguments. Let's say I view those as losers. Would another way to handle that issue is to say, well, let's say for the sake of argument, we don't think the department, that these people are not adjusters. And therefore, while it's possible that you should have responded to the subpoenas and they didn't have to go to the court to get them, we would remand to the commissioner to determine whether these penalties should be revisited based on the fact that we don't think that they were that your clients were not adjusters, therefore this whole investigation, you know, was unnecessary. Do you think there's support for that?
If we are not adjusters, a remand might be appropriate. One other thing.
On the sole issue of the amount of the penalties and whether they should, on the amount of the penalties, not whether the department did or did not have the authority to issue them because you refused to respond to the subpoenas, but simply as to whether, well, let's take a new look at this and maybe that's, you know, different now.
And we're only talking about the penalty on the subpoenas now. That's possible. Your Honor, there's one thing that I should have said in response to your question earlier. Is this is not an utter failure to respond to subpoenas. We did object. And I think in the ordinary course, some discussion and negotiation, oh, I got your objections from a law firm, let's talk about them, would be the next move as opposed to going to court. I don't think anyone would really want to go to court if they didn't have to. And therefore, otherwise it would be to say that a subpoena, the department has no break on its issuance of subpoenas until you're faced with an administrative penalty. That seems a little bit far down the road to be hit with a $10,000. And whether Mr. Larson thinks that's an appropriate penalty or not is really by the by, because that's what the statute says. And to litigate it in the penalty context as opposed to if they issue an information request, that's different. A subpoena that says if you violate a court order, you could be held in contempt. I think it's incumbent upon, if you can't work it out, get a court ruling.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your helpful argument in this case. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the 90-day statutory period.